Broadcasting from behind the Second Amendment Iron Curtain in the shadows of the New York City skyline, this is Gun for Hire Radio, the voice of 1 million New Jersey gun owners, with your hosts, Sandy Berardi and Master Firearms Trainer, Anthony Calandra.
Live from the land that freely forgot the most listened to Second Amendment podcast in the nation. Welcome to it.
Yes, yes, yes. This is show 674, and we have a repeat guest on the show who last week spent the afternoon in Trenton or Camden, and he had oral arguments, I think in conjunction with an FPC attorney, for our assault weapons ban case, as well as our very own solo New Jersey mag ban case that's been bouncing around since, I think, 2018 or sooner. He'll get into that in detail, but everyone this week is like, what happened in court with the assault weapons ban case at the gun range? And I've been telling everybody, listen to show 674, because Dan Schmutter, to a attorney extraordinaire, one of our top 300 heavy lifters here, is going to be on the show and discuss his take on that, as well as we'll talk about the sensitive places and everything that's going on, obviously, around the country. So without further ado, from Hartman Winicky in Ridgewood, New Jersey, Dan Schmutter, welcome back again, my friend.
Thanks, guys. I just would like to wish everyone a Zisen Pesach, or a sweet Passover, which is beginning tomorrow.
Yep.
As you probably can guess, it is not traditional to have either Taylor ham or pork roll on Passover. Though if you were going to do that, you would not have it on a hard roll. You would have it on matzah.
On matzah.
Mm.
Yes, and just
Jewish rye, one or the other.
Or matzah.
Jewish rye with mustard.
Because you can't have.
You can't have leavened bread. That's right. Yeah, it's
gotta be matzah.
But I will say that Passover is one of my favorite holidays. It is one of the quintessential freedom holidays, and so I enjoy Passover every year for that reason.
I'll be at my wife's family's house for Passover, and I'll be there when eating like a stuffed pig. But that's another story.
Very nice.
Not
a stuffed pig, a stuffed lamb.
Eating like a stuffed lamb.
And a shrimp cocktail exactly. As a start. So
no shrimp cocktail.
Yeah, as long as the rabbi blesses it, it's fine.
Yes. Exactly. So Dan, you went to court. How long is our mag ban around? It's like 2018, right?
2018,
I believe.
Yep.
2018, 6 years right. Now, and they put the two cases together, which a lot of people don't understand. So maybe you can start from there. Why is the judge hearing these two separate cases together, our two cases and the one Mark Cheeseman FPC case? All three are bundled together where one of these things is not like the other. Why is the mag case with the two assault weapon ban cases?
So let me just remind your audience about a little bit of the procedural history. So folks will probably remember that we commenced the mag ban case in 2018 when the new mag ban law was enacted. Obviously, there was a 15-round mag limitation for quite a few years, but then in 2018, they reduced that to 10 rounds. And so as soon as that was passed, we immediately sued. That case went through several appeals, went up and down several times to the Third Circuit, and then back down again. Eventually, we filed a petition for certiorari with the United States Supreme Court. That's a petition asking the court to review the case. And that petition was filed at the same time that New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin was being heard and considered by the Supreme Court. So there were a number of cases that were sitting there at the Supreme Court on petition, waiting for the case to be decided. And when Bruin was decided favorably, our case, our mag ban case, along with a bunch of other cases, were given what's called a GVR, grant, vacate, remand. And so the court doesn't decide it on the merits. What the court simply does, it says, okay, we're granting the petition, we're vacating the judgment below, and we're sending it right back down to be redecided in light of our new decision in Bruin. And that's what a GVR is. And a number of cases got GVR, including along with ours. And so it's essentially a do-over. It's we're very pleased with that because it gave us, it breathed new life into the magazine case. because had we not gotten that GVR, the case would have been over. So on our way back down, the remand was to the Court of Appeals, for the Third Circuit. We argued originally that the Court of Appeals should keep the case and just decide the case with briefing and oral argument, rather than sending it back down to the district court for developing a further record. The district court is the trial court. That's where you create a record, either a factual record or a legal record or both. We said, you know what, there are no new facts to develop here. This is simply an issue of law. The Supreme Court clarified the legal rules that govern these cases in Bruin, so you don't have to send it back to the district court. There's nothing to do down there. Why don't you folks decide it? And on a 2-1 decision, we lost. We did have one of the three judges agree with us that there was no reason to send it back down. So it went, but the argument and what ultimately the Third Circuit decided was the argument that won the day for the state in getting it back down to the district court was, look, the Court of Appeals is a court of appeals, and they hear appeals from court's decisions below. So the district court should have the first crack at this, and we'll, if necessary, we'll hear an appeal from the district court, but this is not what we do, and so rather than keeping it, we're just going to send it back down, and maybe we'll see it, down the road if there's an appeal. So that's what happened. We got to the district court, and meanwhile, after Bruin was decided, two assault weapon cases, so-called assault firearm cases, were filed, one by ANGRPC, which is our Ellman versus Platkin case, and one by Firearms Policy Coalition, FPC, which is Cheeseman versus Platkin. And so, and they were filed almost at the same time, kind of like Coons and Siegel, the carry cases, and the state moved to consolidate all three. So what was interesting about this consolidation motion that the state made was it wasn't simply a motion to consolidate the two assault firearm, so-called assault firearm cases, because they were dealing with the same statute, but they also argued that the assault firearm cases should be consolidated with the magazine case because they involved a lot of the same issues. And the court granted that. The court agreed to do that. And we opposed it for a couple of reasons, including, not the least of which, is that the magazine case by then was 5 years old, or at that point was, I guess, 4 years old. And we said, that's not fair. We should be able to proceed with the magazine case because it's so old. These cases are brand new. We shouldn't let these two new cases bog down the old case. But, courts like to be efficient about stuff. Courts like, to keep things tight. And so to have three cases or two cases instead of one case, courts tend to like to put things together to make it more efficient. And so that's what they did. They consolidated all three cases for the purposes of discovery. And discovery, as your listeners may remember, discovery is developing the facts. You ask written questions of the other side. You might take depositions, meaning you might be asking questions under oath with a court reporter in the room. You may exchange documents, things like that. And so that's what we did. And the good news, I guess, is that the state wanted to drag this out much longer than it went. We asked the court for a tighter schedule, and the court I'm not going to say the court split the baby. The court actually imposed a schedule that was closer to what we were asking for than what the state was asking for. You have to get your victories where you can.
Sure.
And so I'm glad at least the court recognized that the state's desire to just drag this out forever was really not going to fly. The judge understood that it had to get moving, and so he did get it moving. But unfortunately, things like discovery and motions and the like do take time. So we finally got to the end of the case, and I'll remind your listeners sort of procedurally what's happening here, because it's very different than where we are in Coons and Siegel, the carry cases. If your listeners may recall that in Coons and Siegel, we brought an application for a temporary restraining order, a TRO, which is an immediate emergency motion for an injunction. It's basically a hair on fire type of motion. It's judge, if you don't we're running into court. If you don't give us relief immediately, terrible things are going to happen. So we need you to look at this really quick and give us relief right away and stop the law from going into effect or halt the effectiveness of the law right away. And then the next step might be a preliminary injunction, which is, Judge, we shouldn't have to live with the effect of this unconstitutional law while we're litigating, because litigation takes years. You should enjoin the law. You should stop its effectiveness while we're litigating, so that we don't have to live with this unconstitutional these unconstitutional restrictions during the pendency of this case, which might take several years. Here, we're at the end of the case, so that's the beginning of the case, and Siegel and Coons are still at that stage because your listeners may recall those cases are on appeal before the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, and they were argued back in October, and we're waiting for a decision. But when the Third Circuit decides that makes a decision, the case comes back to the district court for the rest of the case. I mean, there's so much more to be done in those cases, regardless of which way they rule. I suppose there are certain things they could rule on that they may rule in a way that's more permanent, but generally speaking, at this procedural posture, it's the beginning of the case. Here, we're at the end of the case. We've been through discovery. All the testimony has been presented in writing to the court. We are on what's called summary judgment motions. And what summary judgment motions are a procedure where at the end of the case, prior to trial, because a trial is about the facts of the case. When you go to trial, the purpose of a trial is to determine which facts are true and which facts are not true. You know, was the light red? Was the light green? Did he murder the guy or did he not murder the guy? Just to give his examples, you know, did he pull the trigger? Did he not pull the trigger? Those are factual disputes, and so that's what trials are for. Trials, you don't need trials if the issues are just legal disputes. And so, what summary judgment does, it is an application to the judge saying, Judge, we don't need a trial because there are no factual disputes. All the facts, all the material facts, all the facts that matter are undisputed. And this is all just issues of law. So the court can decide this without a trial. We'll put in affidavits. We'll set forth what the facts are. We will show the court that these are not disputed facts, that we all agree on the facts. And then we'll ask you to make a call on the law and then apply the law to the undisputed facts and rule in our favor and end the case. So that's where we are now. And both sides are saying that to the judge. Now, sometimes, and this is the state is saying, is taking this position, the state is saying, well, the facts that matter to our position are undisputed, but the facts that matter to the plaintiff's position are disputed. So you should rule for us on summary judgment, but if you can't rule for us, well, then we should have a trial. You should deny their motion. And that sometimes that's a valid position. Obviously, we disagree with that. So that's the position. That's where we are right now. So last Thursday, or the week from last Thursday, I should say, we had oral argument on the summary judgment motions. They're very voluminous. There's a lot of paper. The state has 9 expert witnesses, actually 10. One is a rebuttal witness. We have two affirmative expert witnesses plus a rebuttal witness. So there's a ton of paper in the case. And now the judge has to decide what to do.
So now, did those witnesses speak at the summary judgment or no?
No, the court asked us if we were interested in having live testimony. We all agreed that we did not need the witnesses to come in and testify live. I'll tell you an interesting story that arises from this case. So in the magazine case, when we started back in 2018, we originally, when we were applying for a preliminary injunction back then, we went in with papers, just like in Coons and Siegel. And we put in affidavits, sworn statements in writing, with briefs, legal arguments. And when we showed up for oral argument, the judge called us into his chambers and said, you know what, I want to hear from these witnesses. And so we said, well, you want to hear from them live? He said, oh, yeah, I want to hear from them live. Now, that was surprising. Now, that certainly can happen. I mean, there's live testimony in a preliminary injunction is certainly a thing that happens. But it's a little unusual in these kinds of cases, but the judge wanted to hear from the witnesses. He wanted to look him in the eye. And so we ended up having a trial, an actual, you know, sort of a live testimonial hearing for the preliminary injunction. And that's definitely a thing that happens. It's not unusual, but given the particular procedural context and the substance of what we were doing, we thought we were a little surprised by that because we didn't think that was going to be necessary. So in that case, we did have the experts come in and testify on the stand and be cross-examined, things like that. But here, none of the parties thought that was necessary, and the judge was fine with it. In this particular case, he didn't ask us to bring the experts in. And so it's all on paper.
So now all the experts, have they submitted everything already or no? Are they working on that? They have a time frame?
Everything is submitted. The expert reports were submitted over the summer, and we did discovery as to the experts, meaning there were some depositions taken of some of the experts, not all of them, and then the reports were submitted as testimony. That, you know, you don't always do that. Typically you have the experts testify, but in this case, because it's summary judgment, we just agreed that we would submit the reports. And it's all done. The record is now, it's all before the judge. And so the judge has both the written record, all the paper, all the affidavits, all the reports, all the briefs, and the arguments that we made at oral argument. And now he has his work cut out for him because it's a big record.
And what are you thinking time frame?
Well, you know, so it's interesting that there's a lot that might affect that. Now, of course, I say this all the time. I never want to make predictions like this because
I get it.
It's impossible to predict. A long time ago, I got burned so many times when I was a young lawyer trying to figure this stuff out that I realized it's an impossible task. But some factors to think about. Number one, the record is very substantial, and because this is the end of the case rather than the beginning of the case, the kinds of time constraints and concerns that might be appropriate in the context of a temporary restraining order, which the plaintiff, you know, where the plaintiff is seeking extremely fast relief, or even a preliminary injunction where the plaintiff is seeking pretty quick relief, those don't apply here because this is the end of the case. There's no particular deadline to meet. Like if you think about 2018, when we were seeking a preliminary injunction in the magazine case, there was a 6-month, there was a 180-day implementation period. And so the law was passed, I think, in maybe April or something like that, and it wasn't due to go into effect until October. And so we told the judge, we said, you know, we're asking for relief before the law goes into effect. Otherwise, people are going to have to dispose of their magazines or sell them or get rid of them or destroy them or modify them. And so we said there's a hard deadline where we really need to have relief if we're going to get it. And so when you're dealing with a TRO or a preliminary injunction, it's very often the case that there's a real world deadline that is important for the court to meet if they're going to afford meaningful relief to the plaintiff, assuming the court agrees that relief is appropriate. Here, that's not the case. Now, obviously, every day people are restricted by unconstitutional laws, they're suffering constitutional injury. But there's nothing particular about tomorrow versus the next day versus the next day. It's all the same injury. And so the court is going to treat this, you know, I mean, I can't say one way or the other whether he's going to sit on this or whether he's going to expedite it or whatever, but it doesn't have the same urgency as a TRO or a preliminary injunction. Now, there are some other considerations to think about. These are all just kind of things that might matter. There's a few other cases that are pending that could affect how this judge thinks about the case. The Supreme Court will be deciding no later than the end of June, the case United States versus Rahimi. That was argued a number of months ago, and that case is not an arms ban case like the magazine case and the so-called assault firearm case, but it is a case being decided by the Supreme Court. It is going to apply in one way or another Heller and McDonald and Bruin. And so, it you know, a court might think to themselves, you know, I may care about what the Supreme Court says in Rahimi, and so I may choose to just wait until we hear from the Supreme Court in June in case there's some important thing that they announce, some important rule or procedure or concept that they announce that might be relevant to this case. So that's a possibility, right? And then there's another more direct possibility, which is that there is another case within the Third Circuit, which is our circuit, that coming out of Delaware, which deals with the same subject matter. So there are cases, a series of cases, dealing with magazines and assault weapons, so-called assault weapons, that is at the Third Circuit now, and was argued a number of weeks ago. And so the court could easily say, you know, it could very easily impact this case, how the Third Circuit rules on the Delaware cases, and so I ought to wait for that. So there's and there's other stuff too, but there's because there are a lot of magazine cases and so-called assault weapon cases around the country. That's not something that I would expect this court to wait for, because cases get litigated all the time. But those are two things, or three considerations, that could impact timing.
Now, what a lot of people don't understand that are new to the 2A game and listening to podcasts and the energy that's out there is this is no different than what happened after, like, Heller and McDonald and then Bruin. You get all of these cases percolating through all the lower courts across the entire country, correct? And that's what got us to Bruin, right?
Right. And magazines and so-called assault weapons are a great example of that, because they represent right now the single largest number of cases percolating through the court system. There are magazine and assault weapon cases in California, in New Jersey, in Maryland, in Delaware, in Illinois, in Oregon, I mean, everywhere. So, and they're all hurtling in the same direction, sort of headlong towards the Supreme Court. Now, they're in a variety of procedural postures, which is what makes it all very interesting, because some are at the preliminary injunction stage, just like Coons and Siegel. Some of them, like us, are at the end of the case, and that's actually an important difference between Delaware and us. Delaware cases are at the PI, the preliminary injunction stage. We're at the end of the case. So, and interestingly, one of the things I found very interesting about the oral argument in the Delaware cases is that most of the questions that the panel was asking the lawyers was about the concept of the preliminary injunction. Whether the preliminary injunction standards, because in order to get a preliminary injunction, you have to satisfy certain requirements in the record. And so a lot of the questioning, probably almost all of the questioning, was about that, about the preliminary injunction procedure itself. So, you know, the ruling in the Delaware cases that comes down from the Third Circuit may be mostly or entirely about preliminary injunctions and may have very little to do with our case. Or they could rule entirely on the merits. You know, I mean, there's no way to know, but that's an interesting difference between our cases and the Delaware cases, even though we're within the same circuit, and even though the Court of Appeals that governs our judge in our district is going to be ruling on a case that's you know, that has similar issues, because they're procedurally in a different place than we are, it's very possible that case may not have a great impact on our situation. And so and it's all over the map, literally. I mean, I just listed a whole bunch of states, but it's literally all over the map in the sense that so many of these cases are in different procedural postures. And so you don't know. I feel very confident that at some point, these issues are going to get to the Supreme Court. The question is when and which case or cases will it be? It's very hard to answer that question for all the usual reasons, but more than just the usual reasons, the additional reasons is that there are so many of these cases out there, and they're in so many different stages. You never know which is the case that piques the court's interest, which is the one that they think is the right vehicle to deal with these issues.
Now, some questions for you. A lot of people ask this question. We already know the answer. We're limited in New Jersey to 10 rounds now. Our lawsuit, we're not looking to go back to 15. We're going back to standard capacity, correct?
Yeah, this is a challenge to the very idea of limiting magazine capacity. The arguments that we've made apply to any magazine limitations, you know, of any limitation on standard capacity magazines. It wouldn't make legal or constitutional sense to say it's unconstitutional to limit magazines to 10 rounds, but it's constitutional to limit magazines to 15 rounds. That's nonsensical.
So a Glock 17 would have 17 rounds in New Jersey.
I'm not a Glock guy, so I'll have to take your word for
that. But that's as Gaston Glock intended it. Now, what about the assault weapons ban? So all the evil features that New Jersey puts out there would all be gone. We would be able to have flash suppressors, retractable stock, a pistol grip, folding stock, or whatever, correct? For the people that are new to this.
Well, a couple of things. So we're asking for all of that stuff.
Yes.
How the court rules, because the court could rule for us on some things and not on other things. Don't forget, I keep bringing up Coons and Siegel, because Coons and Siegel are really, really richly detailed cases that illustrate a great deal about how the legal system works. It's a nice thing about those cases. There's a lot of good law stuff in those cases. And I know a lot of your listeners have been following those cases very closely. And so as they may recall, we got some of the relief that we asked for, and some of the relief we asked for was denied. Mm-hmm. And on remand, when the Third Circuit makes this decision, whatever that happens to be, there are more opportunities to get more stuff, or we could end up with less stuff when the smoke clears at the end of the day. So, who knows? If this judge in the magazine and so-called assault weapon cases could give us some relief, no relief, all of our relief. At one point, he asked the state a very interesting question. He said, if I were to uphold the magazine law, why do you have to restrict the assault weapons? What's the point at that point? If what you're really complaining about is magazine capacity and things like rate of fire, if I uphold the magazine law, what's the point of restricting the weapons themselves? Now, you and I and your listeners know the answer to that question. We understand why each of the aspects of these laws that are being challenged are grossly unconstitutional and also endanger people and make people less safe. But just the fact that the judge asked that question illustrates that we're asking for a lot of different relief here, and the court could easily is actually the wrong word. I don't think easily is the correct way of describing it, but could give us some relief and not all relief, or no relief, or could give us everything. Obviously, there's a million different things that can happen here. I'll use this opportunity to describe something that I thought was very interesting that happened at oral argument, which was interesting and gratifying. There were a number of times when the state was arguing where the judge acknowledged, this is actually very interesting, judges don't often do this, but the judge acknowledged that he knew very little about firearms. But when the state was arguing, more than once he said to the attorney, he said, the legislature did X, Y, and Z. How does that make sense? And so on a number of occasions, he expressed sort of a basic skepticism of the regulatory scheme based on what the statute does and what its ostensible purpose is and how it might relate to the Constitution, but exhibiting a healthy skepticism of the logic of what the state is doing is very helpful to us in that at least the judge seems to understand to a certain extent, some of the nonsensical aspects of the regulatory structure, which is, I think, can only be helpful to us.
That seems to be a rarity, too, doesn't it, Dan? Isn't it an aberration?
I don't think it's a rarity. What it does show, though,
in the history of like New Jersey in dealing with this particular issues.
Well, I mean, I think it, you know, we're so used to thinking that everybody is on one side or the other.
Yeah.
You're either pro or anti. You either love us or hate us. And, you know, those kinds of comments and questions on the record tend to suggest that this judge doesn't have a particular viewpoint, you know, yay or nay, good or bad. Mm. You know, the questions seemed to indicate just sort of genuine skepticism from the point of view and the perspective of someone who doesn't know the field very well. You know, and it's interesting because some people had asked me, why? Because there were a bunch of people at the argument, supporting our efforts, which was very nice. And you know, at the end of the argument, somebody asked me, well, you know, how do the judge admitted that he doesn't know much or anything about guns? How is that fair? Why can't we get someone who knows about guns? And the answer to that is really simple. Judges are by design supposed to be generalists. They're not supposed to necessarily know much or anything about the subject matter of the lawsuit. It's the job of the lawyers and the evidence to teach the judge about the subject matter. You know, my job is to explain it, you know, in writing and live at oral argument, you know, to the extent where that's appropriate. And it's my job to frame and present the evidence in a way that it teaches the judge the subject matter. And that's how courts are designed. The judges, there are exceptions to that. There are certain kinds of subject matter situations in courts where you actually do want a subject matter expert, or where you have, you know, certain specialized subject matter courts. But usually, judges are generalists, and that's how this works. It's my job and the job of the witnesses and the evidence to educate the judge as to the subject matter and show the judge why we're right and why we're entitled to the relief that we're asking for.
Makes sense.
Nice. I'm going to take a break and do housekeeping, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Others, 1791, and our carry case with sensitive places. So take a break, Dan. I got you when you get back. NYTACDefense.com, NYTACDEFENSE.com. Peter Tillum, if you live in New York, anywhere in New York City and the state, NYTACDefense, use Gun for Hire, one word, for a membership discount. U.S. Law Shield, uslawshield.com. They're changing their membership structures. Evan Knappen will be here, and the U.S. Law Shield people will be here on Friday, 5/10/2024, from 5:30 till 7:30 p.m. Sign up online for the seminar. Knappen will be here, and U.S. Law Shield people will be here to describe the changes. If you need a book, Decoding Firearms Are Crime Proof, Gun for Hire, Think Like a Criminal and Beat Them at Their Own Game, you can get it here. You can get it at Aberdeen Guns in Monmouth County. Go and ask for my buddy John down there and tell him I said hello. My doctor is Optimal Health Wellness NJ, Optimal Health Wellness NJ, concierge medicine. You will never go back to a doctor's office after doing this. I kid you not. Lake Island Rifle and Pistol Club in Carteret, New Jersey is looking for junior rifle members 12 to 18 years old to learn firearm safety and to compete in small bore and air rifle competition. They are our future. Visit lakeis.org. If you're in the Scotch Plains area, check out Zen Float Center and tell Sharon Decker we said hello. For the news out there, news, N-E-W-S, number 2, letter A.com, News2A on all the social media platforms, or you can visit their website. Varsity Firearms Podcast with John Valenti. Support those who support you. Standstrong.biz is over 400 businesses, products, and services. Go there first. If you go on standstrong.biz and you look up attorneys, Dan Schmutter is going to come up on Hartman Winicky. He did a video with him during COVID and the whole bit. So anything you need that Dan's office does, which Dan will tell us when we come back from the break, you should be visiting him first, supporting those who support you. Correct? Right. Now, a couple of things. John Acapinti didn't send me an update for the NRA dinner that's coming up October 2nd at the Tides Estate in North Jersey. There's another dinner also September 14th in Atlantic County, and there's another dinner October 17th, Hunterdon County. So let's get going. Tickets are almost sold out for John's dinner, and we need more sponsors. Couple of things. I got some good stuff here. This is from Bart. Much appreciated shout out on podcast 673. two topics that keep coming up in my mind are, how can we encourage gun owners to get out of the closet and be great ambassadors in their communities? That's a tough one, Bart, because, you know, Sandy coined the phrase a long time ago in New Jersey that we have closet gun owners. A lot of people can't come out. They don't want to be shunned. They don't want to be treated like me when I'm out in public or walking my dog and old ladies come up to me and tell me to drop dead in the community I live in. It's hard. Everybody can do what they can do, whether it's donating, volunteering their time, bringing people to the range. We are, in fact, an army of activists, but everybody has different strengths and weaknesses, and not everybody can risk their job, their career, their livelihood. So it's tough. But what is the to-do list for a new person to become an activist? Join ANJRPC. Join CNJFO, obviously. Donate, FPC. Contact CNJFO or Tony Simon or Ree Tang and say, I'd like to volunteer. I'd like to help. I'd like to come and help you guys out. That would be a great thing that people can do. And then Bart wanted to know about the civic seminar. So, Bart, this was a brainchild that grew off the radio show. And Trevor and a few other people took the reins. We're going to have seminars here, hopefully in the fall, where people will be able to come in and know how to act and what to say and get it on record when you go into your town and council meetings so that we can get a grassroots effort across the state. Also, Assemblyman Auth wants to come in and talk to people about voter registration and early voting and mail-in ballots and everything else. So it's coming. Listen, it's coming. Todd Smith sent me a great email about he listens to the show every week. He's a former New Jersey resident who now lives in Missouri. God bless, a free state. And when he's driving through, he loves to visit, and he thanks Sandy and I for all of our support and everything we do to get the word out. I appreciate that. I got a great thank you note from Wyatt Monteferrant, who wrote, "You have done more for me than you probably know. You've opened a place for my dad and I that we can go and spend quality time together and become closer." They've been coming here weekly since he's, I don't know how old he was, but it's 12 years now. "You've given me a job that got me back on my feet after COVID and allowed me to meet the great people that work at the range. And now you've given me an opportunity to pursue my dream. Thank you for everything you've done for me, and thank you for being the person you are." Wyatt Monteferrant. He was looking to shadow a physician's assistant as he increased his medical career, and gun people being the best people. I sent emails out to my doctor, Dr. Sambatero, and Mike Candido from Jay Moore and everything. And lo and behold, and I think John Valenti too, lo and behold, 1, 2, 3, he got multiple offers. So I love that shit. Real quick, if you saw the teaser, Sandy, I got a set of suspenders.
Nice.
From Rich Bowen. "Life is easier with an up Lula, a good pair of suspenders, and a sock aid. You can live without them all, but why make life harder for yourself than it needs to be?" Rich Bowen. Rich, thank you. When I walk around the house with the suspenders on, my wife is going to throw a knife at me. But thank you so much. I really appreciate the gesture and the gift. And I will try them on when the weather is a little cooler and I'm wearing an overshirt. It reminds me of a post I saw on Facebook where somebody was saying they were a middle-aged, stocky guy, and they were talking about different ways to carry. I think that was Dan Schmutter. So Dan Schmutter's office is Hartman Winicky in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Dan, what do you guys specialize in?
Well, we have a very substantial practice in estate planning and estate administration. That's actually how the firm started many years ago. So we do wills and trusts and all kinds of great stuff like that. Both, you know, we prepare them, and we also administer estates after a person passes. And we do commercial transactions. We do a lot of real estate. And, of course, we have a very interesting and eclectic litigation practice. And we do more than just civil rights litigation. We do commercial litigation. My partner does internet and e-commerce law and litigation. So it's an interesting mix of stuff. I encourage your listeners to go to www.hartmanwinicky, that's HartmanWinicky.com, and take a look at what we do. The attorneys all have bio pages, and we have our practice pages that describe the various things we do. So take a look, and maybe we can help you out.
Thank you so much, Dan. Now, Dan, two things, and then back to you. this assault weapons case that's going on, will that affect others as well? Or is it specific to just evil features?
Well, when you say, I mean, they're all, so they are all
the big cases, question I get.
All of the, you mean other assault weapon laws?
Yeah, the others, you know, the ones with the short barrel rifles.
Oh,
and everything.
Others. Yes. Oh, others. Oh, oh, yeah. No. I'm sorry. I don't think I don't think in those terms. Sorry. No, that's right. No, it unlikely because it doesn't really deal with those issues. I mean, could it indirectly advance advance the law in a way that might help the issue of others? Perhaps, but it doesn't directly implicate that.
Gotcha. So the last thing, we had a court, was it Third Circuit, where a judge says that the date is 1791. Am I correct?
Right. So that case.
Tell the listeners about the importance of that.
Yeah. So that is a case called Lara versus Commissioner of State Police of Pennsylvania. It was decided by the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which governs our district in New Jersey, as well as Pennsylvania, Delaware, and the Virgin Islands. And it was on its facts, it was about 18 to 20-year-old adults and their rights to carry. But in the course of rendering a decision favorable to the plaintiffs in that case, and vindicating those rights, the court decided an issue that has not really been decided previously, which is, what is the proper historical time frame to examine the historical tradition of firearms regulation? Let me remind your listeners about what the nuts and bolts of the Second Amendment is, as far as what courts are required to do in evaluating whether a law is compliant with the Second Amendment or whether it's unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. And the concept was set forth in Heller, but because of 12 years of courts getting it wrong, the Supreme Court decided to clarify it in excruciating detail in the Bruin decision, because courts were just not doing it right. And so the idea, the first thing you have to do when you're examining whether a law is consistent with the Second Amendment or whether it violates the Second Amendment, is to see whether the conduct that the plaintiff or the claim that the plaintiff is making implicates the text of the Second Amendment. Does it even fall within the Second Amendment? Once you're satisfied that the answer is yes, then the burden shifts to the state to demonstrate that the challenged law is consistent with the historical tradition of firearms regulation. Well, how do you find the historical tradition? What you have to do is you have to go back and determine what is called the original public meaning of the Second Amendment. The leading and correct method of constitutional interpretation is called originalism. And the particular flavor of originalism, because there's a couple of different ways to think about originalism in the context of interpreting the Constitution, the leading and, again, correct version is called original public meaning. And what that means is, if you want to understand what the Constitution means, what the language actually means, you have to glean what the original meaning of that language was at the time it was adopted, and what people living at the time would have understood that language to mean if they read it. And that's the original public meaning of a constitutional provision. Now, here's the problem. Well, it's not really a problem, but it adds a little bit of complexity. So the Second Amendment was ratified in 1791. And so one would think, oh, of course. So it's the original public meaning of the Second Amendment in 1791 that tells you what that means, right? So if you were living in the United States in 1791, what would you have thought that language meant in terms of what the right to keep and bear arms is, and what sorts of restrictions on the right to keep and bear arms would be valid and which ones would be invalid? But it's complicated by the fact that the Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment, was not originally applicable to the states. Originally, the Bill of Rights was a restriction on the federal government. That's what its purpose was. The Bill of Rights was adopted because of the fear of the anti-federalists that creating a strong national government would cause the new government to infringe on basic fundamental liberties. And so the Bill of Rights was a compromise that they made. They said, look, we'll ratify your Constitution, but we need some sort of Bill of Rights. And so after the Constitution was ratified, the first Congress then started proposing amendments to the Constitution in order to implement this Bill of Rights that was promised. And so originally it was just about the federal government. Well, that all changed after the Civil War. That changed as a result of the Civil War. It was realized that state governments can infringe on fundamental rights just as much as the federal government could, and so the deal was changed. In the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment did a lot of stuff, but one of the things the 14th Amendment did was it changed the deal. It made the Bill of Rights applicable to the states as well as the federal government. And so some scholars in law review articles have argued, and as a result of that, many states, in trying to uphold their laws, and some courts have agreed with this, have argued that, no, if you want to know what the original public meaning of the right to keep and bear arms is as it relates to the states, you have to look at the meaning in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was adopted, not 1791, mm-hmm. because it didn't apply to the states at that time. So in Bruin, if you go back and read Bruin, there's a brief discussion of this issue. And the court recognizes that there's a scholarly debate over this issue. Is it 1791 that you look at? And the reason it matters is because in order to determine whether a regulation that's challenged is consistent with the historical tradition of firearms regulation, you have to look at the historical tradition of firearms regulation in the relevant time frame. And so and the state has to say, see, this is how arms were regulated historically, and therefore we can regulate it now in the way we're doing it because the history, it's consistent with the historical regulatory scheme back then. The question becomes, which back then are we talking about? Are we talking about back then in or around 1791, or are we talking about back then in or around 1868, and it can often matter a great deal, because as your listeners may imagine, regulation of all sorts of things, but including regulation of arms, increased over time, and with the 20th century and the 21st century being massively a greater regulation, but even in the 19th century, there was more regulation than in the 18th century. So if you're talking about 1868, it gives the opportunity for states like New Jersey to try to offer examples of laws at that time that they would argue form the historical tradition. Whereas if you go back to 1791, they're going to have a much harder time finding laws. Now, one of the things we discovered in the cases in all the post Bruin cases, including Coons and Siegel, and including these cases and some of the others, is that the state really has an incredibly difficult time even finding valid historical citations, even in the 19th century. What they do is they try to paste them together to try to form an historical tradition, and it really doesn't. But at least they have more to choose from in that failed effort than they do from 1791. So it's a big deal, because in the Lara decision, the Lara case, the Third Circuit ruled that 1791 is the correct time frame, and not 1868, particularly where they conflict, obviously. Where they don't conflict, it doesn't matter. But it did matter in the Lara case for the 18 to 20-year-old issue. And so having decided that 1791 is the correct historical time frame, that's very helpful for us, because it really shows, and there are many good reasons why the court was correct. I don't know if you want me to spend time on that, because I know we have limited time, but there are many good reasons why the court was correct about picking 1791 as the correct time frame. But it's very helpful in that it does really show how little regulation of arms there was, and how very broad the right to keep and bear arms was understood to be at the time the Second Amendment was ratified.
So it's it it's good that this judge mentioned this now, because it's going to carry some weight in other cases, especially in the Third Circuit. Obviously, you're going to refer to that ruling, correct?
And we have. It's not just going to carry some weight. It should be binding. It's a ruling of the Third Circuit, it's not an individual judge. It was a Third Circuit panel. So it is supposed to be binding on the circuit. Here's why I say should be. Your listeners may have heard of the concept of rehearing en banc, ENBANC. And what rehearing en banc means is that if you're unsatisfied with the decision of your three-judge panel in the Court of Appeals, you can ask the full court, all of the judges, to rehear the case. And that's called en banc. It's when the court mm-hmm. sits en banc, it's all of the judges. Well, it's all the active judges. It doesn't include senior judges, but that's sort of a technical point. But it's the full court hearing it, and an application was made by the state of Pennsylvania for rehearing en banc, and that was denied. And so what that means is that the Lara decision stands, at least until and unless the Supreme Court has something to say about it. But an important thing happened, and it's of a little bit of concern. I'm not sure what to make of it, but there was a dissenting opinion filed in the denial of rehearing en banc. And one of the judges, Judge Krause, said quite a few things in that dissenting opinion on the merits, but also said, and I believe she's mistaken about this, but she said that the three-judge panel in Lara should not have ruled the way it did on the 1791 versus 1868 issue, because the Third Circuit had already ruled on that issue in a case called Range. She's mistaken. The court did not rule on that issue in Range, but because she thinks that the court did previously rule in Range and ruled differently, she believes, at least the way she describes it in her opinion, I worry that she believes that Lara is not binding. Now, Judge Krause happens to be one of our judges in Coons and Siegel at the Third Circuit. So it does concern me if Judge Krause is in fact of the view that she's not required to follow Lara on the 1791 versus 1868 issue.
Sure.
But we'll see. Look, I don't know whether that means she's not going to follow it, or whether she was simply criticizing the panel for doing something that she thinks they should not have done. I don't know. We'll see, right? I mean, when the Third Circuit panel rules on Coons and Siegel, we may see, I don't know who's going to write the opinion, but if Judge Krause writes the opinion, we may see her talk about Lara and why she thinks she doesn't have to follow it. Or she may not. I don't know. Maybe she'll write a concurring opinion or hopefully a dissenting opinion in which she says, perhaps she'll say that the court should not have followed Lara. There's no way to know what's going to happen, but she said this in a written opinion, and so this is clearly something that Judge Krause has thought about, and it could affect what she does in some of these cases. So, there's a lot of moving parts here. There's complexity here which can matter.
Of course, of course. And you're on top of it all. So what can people do besides listening to the show? By the way, we're approaching, we have like two or three more shows, and we're going to be entering our 15th year of podcasting. How many people even knew what a podcast was, and how many podcasts were there 15 years ago, Sandy, when we started this?
We literally had to teach people how to use it.
Oh, daily. How do I listen to you guys? Where do I go? And, when Sandy approached me and said, you should do a podcast for you new listeners, the first thing I said to him was, what's a podcast? And we took it from there. I mean, wow, we're approaching. We'll be a show, I think, 677 will be our 15th year, breaking cherry on our 15th year. Can you imagine that? Oh, my God.
That's amazing.
Dan.
Congratulations.
Yeah, right? It's amazing. 15 years. And we're in the top 1% of downloaded podcasts in the country. For example, Joe Rogan is in the top 0.01% of podcasts, but we're up there. You know, John Petrolino did a search on us a while back, and he was like, you guys realize how much impact you have? And I'm like, well, based on how many times people recognize me and how many emails and messages that we get, yeah, I figure we're out there. But knowledge is power, and if it wasn't for alternative information like this, 90% of the people out there wouldn't know what's going on. And so it's important. So Dan, talk to us about the importance of being a member of ANJRPC, NRA, donating, and staying aware. Help us out here as we're starting to wind down.
Well, you've read my mind, Anthony, because one of the things that I want to mention, and your show is a great part of that, but there is one of the things that I have learned over the years, especially recently, is the intense level of energy that exists among New Jersey gun owners. And there's certainly more people that can get involved and more people that should get involved, but the number of people that are involved and the intensity of their involvement is extraordinary. You know, we live behind enemy lines here, and it would be very easy for folks to roll over and die. But we don't, and it's you're a great advocate of sort of big tent civil rights, and I've always been impressed by that because it is very helpful and very powerful to spread the tent wide and bring everybody into the movement, regardless of what organizations they belong to, regardless of what their particular approach to the movement is. You know, you've mentioned organizations, ANJRPC, FPC, SAF, CNJFO. You know, I mean, we had when we were at the courthouse, we had people in the courtroom with us from Women for Gun Rights, used to be called the DC Project. And when you looked out into the courtroom, it was all teal T-shirts. There were no red T-shirts there. It was all
Sandy's
teal,
gonna be
no
on the
red.
Show. Sandy Hickerson, she's going to be on the show. She was the one there passing the shirts out. I'm going to see her at the CNJFO dinner, the Women for Gun Rights dinner. Is that Quint?
That is Quint. That is Quint.
Yeah, he's allowed to come on the show. So he's been on the show now. Rex has been on the show. Winston's been on the show, Sandy. That's it. Right. We've had three. Oh, we've had other dogs,
we've
too.
Had
and we had
dogs.
Frank
yeah,
on the show with the dogs.
Dogs.
I love it.
Quint doesn't understand why he doesn't have a headset and doesn't get to weigh in on these weighty issues.
Of course he does.
Well, he hasn't passed the bar yet.
And he was looking at me saying, you know, why don't I get to talk? And obviously he got impatient with that and is vocalizing. So, you know, that's the way it works. But the level of intensity of people's devotion to the movement, people and dogs, is very impressive and very gratifying. People go on to Facebook, they go on to the Syndicate page, they go on to the Gun for Hire radio page, they go on to the New Jersey Gun Owners page, they go all over the place, and they ask questions, they answer questions, they raise ideas, and it's astonishing to me in the sense that it is so easy to expect people to be beaten down. You know, we live in a very, very hostile environment. I don't have to tell your listeners that. And so living in a hostile environment, New Jerseyans rise to the occasion and fight back, you know, with great energy. It's really, really great to watch, and it's great to see. So people just need to keep doing it. People get tired of me hearing me say this, I'm sure. But I always say this is a marathon, not a sprint. And what that means is that you have to keep pushing. It takes time, but you have to keep pushing. Look at where we are compared with 2007, the year before Heller was decided. It's a whole different world. Yeah. And the anti-rights people, the people, the tyrants, the people who want to keep us down, the people who want to prevent us from exercising our fundamental rights are on their heels. When Bruin came down, they couldn't believe it. I mean, they literally threw temper tantrums. New York, then New Jersey, then Maryland. You know, I'm talking about the Bruin response legislation, where they basically said, oh, yeah, we have to issue permits. Okay, we'll try to make use of that permit. We're now going to pass laws that make it impossible to use those permits that you fought so hard to get. Well, my message to them, and it's not really my message to them, it's gun owners' message to them, is tough noogies, we're going to vindicate our rights. We will march forward continually, and there's, you know, there may be some setbacks. There may be some times when we see a bad ruling, or we experience a bad ruling, or we're frustrated because something happens, you know, or they pass another law. But this is moving forward. It takes time. It takes energy. It takes money. It takes effort. It takes intensity. But it is moving forward. We are winning. And it's because of the people who care so much about being free. You know, and it's not just New Jerseyans, although New Jerseyans are excellent examples of it. It's an American thing. You know, people take for granted the rights that we have here and the liberty that we have here, but it is ingrained in our culture, and it's ingrained in our being that we as Americans are constantly fighting for liberty and fighting for freedom. We are constantly pushing our rights forward because it's unacceptable for us to not be free. People all over the world take for granted the fact they're just going to be crushed by some sort of authoritarian tyrannical government. Mm-hmm. We don't think that here. We assume that we have a right to be free because we do, and we make it so. And that's what I love about this experience, because I get to be part of it and I get to be energized by all the people that care about it. And that's extraordinary to me.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think people here are realizing, more and more people are realizing, that our freedoms and liberties are truly, in fact, not tinfoil hat ways, but truly being threatened on a daily basis from many, many fronts.
100%, nonstop. And that's one of the reasons why all the cases that go to the Supreme Court come out of our states, because we're fighting for it. Because when you live in Kentucky, you take your rights for granted.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why all the most conservative states have the weakest Republicans, because the Republicans there, they don't have to do crap. We right. can't get a good Republican in New Jersey, but in the red states, their Republicans are all sissies. Look, like Mitt Romney, et cetera, Lindsey right. Graham. Right. Right. They don't have to do anything.
Absolutely. And they sit back and they just expect, you know, they don't. It's kind of funny, too. And I'm sure you're experiencing the same thing in Florida, is the fact that the people who are there, who have been there for either born and raised there, you know, here in Alabama, most of the people who were born and raised here or came from states that are just normal American states, find it extremely hard to even comprehend how we have to live in New
yep.
Jersey. They
yep.
just don't. They don't. They think you're kind of making it up, or you're embellishing it.
Yeah, everybody's always in amazement. Really?
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
it true that you have to wait for this? Is it true that that's how it works? They're amazed. Unbelievable. Yes, they are amazed. Dan, go ahead.
But we have the calluses to prove
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes us tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes
yes.
us tough.
Absolutely.
I agree. I agree with you 100%. We're fighters and we do what we have to do. So, Dan, you want to wrap it up? Tell us one more time where people can find you, and then we'll hit it.
Yes. Well, so my firm is Hartman and Winicky. We are located in Ridgewood. The number there is 201-967-8040, 201-967-8040, or www.hartmanwinicky.com. I encourage you to take a look at our website and look at the attorney pages, look at our practice areas. You know, we'd love to, we've gotten, you know, and Anthony, I have to thank you for the opportunity to say these things on your show, because, you know, I get plenty of people who are looking for a will or looking for a trademark registration. We do trademarks, all kinds of stuff, saying, hey, you know, I heard you on Anthony's show, and yes. You know, can you help me with this non-gun related thing?
And, that's what it's all about.
You know, so yeah, we'd love to help, would help folks out with whatever their legal needs are. If we can do it, we'd love to do it.
Which beautiful. Is good, because Sandy, there are more problems than just gun problems.
Oh, yeah. And Dan, we'll have you back on as soon as one of these cases drop, so you can give us right from the horse's mouth, or right from Quint's mouth. You could tell us what's going on. Give him a big hug from me. Oh, Sandy, beautiful. You want to wrap it up?
Dan, thank you. You know, it's always a pleasure, because you take the time to explain each and every intricate part of the law to us lay people.
Right.
It's my pleasure, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. I really do
appreciate it. We love you, Dan. Thank you so much.
Well, it looks like you've done it again. You've wasted yet another perfectly good hour of listening to Gun for Hire Radio. Gun for Hire Radio is a kind of production. America! By Cosmo Music, New York, New York. America. On behalf of my show host, Master Trainer Anthony Calandro, God shed his grace like a criminal and beat them at their own game, which amazing! He actually remembered to speak about today and tell you where you can buy it. Wherever great books are sold, at Gunshot Bookshop, Gun from sea to shine and sea. Not in places where they sell shitty liberal books, but here where they sell good books. Well, we love you guys from the shadows of the New York City skyline and the beautiful Gulf Shores of Alabama, where it's 86 degrees and sunny right now.
Yes, it's great here in New Jersey.
We love you guys. A happy, happy Passover to everybody. God carries in the barracks. Hold out. We will see you next week. And the next door neighbor dog says goodbye.